he's the head of a country, and I mean he is the strong head. Mm-hmm. Don't let anyone think anything different. Right. He speaks and his people sit up at attention. I want my people to do the right. same.
And she is a great gentleman. He's now president-elect.
Putin's a killer. A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why you think our country's so innocent?
And we had Saddam Hussein, and if we had Gaddafi in charge, instead of having terrorism all over the place, would be at least they killed terrorists, all right?
President Trump praising dictators and autocrats, Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, even blasts from the past like Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi. As the world watches how Xi and Trump respond to weeks of Hong Kong protests against mainland China, and how Russia is responding to a nuclear accident amidst a new arms race, how much of what's at stake globally depends on the whims of political strongmen? Foreign Affairs magazine is devoting an entire issue to dictators around the world, and Gideon Rose joins me now. He's the editor of Foreign Affairs, and welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Just to start, there's no consensus on the role individuals play in history. So relative to all these other forces at work, why focus a whole issue on autocrats?
Well, it's actually really funny because there is no consensus in the scholarly community, but most people actually assume that people matter a lot. So biographies of great men and women, evil or good, are huge bestsellers. We all fixate on the papers, on the individual characteristics of individual decision makers, but the scholars tend to explain things in terms of broad outcomes. But in real time, what we actually can see as individual human beings following the news is that individual decisions by individual human beings in power make a lot of difference. And okay. So what we decided to do was focus on the most important individuals in power in the world today who are driving their country's authoritarian turns and taking world politics in a kind of despotic direction.
Okay, well, you had me at the word autocrat. But why don't we define our terms? What is an autocrat?
Well, it's a great, if you think of a Democrat as somebody who basically rules with the will of the people or with the legitimacy of popular support, an autocrat is somebody who has power and uses it without that. So it's simply somebody who has power without legitimacy, or rather without popular legitimacy. And these days, the leading figures in world politics, Xi in China, Putin in Russia, Erdogan in Turkey, Orban, Duterte in the Philippines, these are all men, and it's not an accidental that they're men, who basically are outsiders who have taken control of their countries and turned them into sort of personal dictatorships, personalized authoritarian systems, and are acting kind of savvily but aggressively on the global stage as well. And with the U.S. no longer playing a sort of major active role in world politics in the Trump era, these guys have the field to themselves and are running with it.
Let's talk about Putin. Your author writes that he models himself on Peter the Great. How do you see that reflected in Putin's governing style?
Well, so the coolest part about looking at the individual people is they all turn out to have slightly different personalities, personal heroes, and things driving them. For Putin, as you say, it seems like restoring Russia's imperial greatness, tradition, the authority of religion, the authority of nationalism, these are the kinds of things that would be familiar to anybody occupying the Kremlin over the last half millennium, and that's what Putin wants to do in his office.
What does labeling him an autocrat do for understanding his or Russia's influence on world affairs?
Well, it's a great question because essentially what it means is you have to understand who Vladimir Putin is and what makes him tick in order to understand what Russia is doing. So this is not an aggressive, domineering world power trying to conquer new lands. It's a resentful former imperial power trying to come back, feeling like it's lost its position in the world. And so things like respect, things like treating them like a real power and being sensitive to their security concerns and other sorts of maintenance of power concerns is something that they demand as a right. And so what they see themselves doing in terms of interfering in American elections, Russia sees itself as doing exactly what we have done to Russia by promoting democracy promotion. They see themselves as simply engaging in political warfare on our shores the way we have engaged in their eyes in political warfare on their shores by supporting democracy promotion, which would kick out Putin. So being aware that we're more symmetrical with the Russians than we think, and they have legitimate concerns and rights, and that something like a negotiated deal on arms control with a fellow nuclear power makes sense, and that they also want stability and are not just crazy, frothing-at-the-mouth tyrants, that helps you understand Russian policy, I think, a little bit better.
Well, turning to Xi Jinping, the author of your article on him calls him the party man, a true believer in communism and the party's right to rule China. So that makes him a by-the-book communist. What makes him an autocrat?
Well, it's not so much a by-the-book communist, because the parts of communism that he is drawing on and likes are the Leninism more than the Marxism, you might say, the dominant party vanguard leading everything, less the giant economic concern. And so China is rapidly becoming quite capitalist and is essentially now more kind of authoritarian crony capitalist than it is a communist country. The party is just basically the ruling elite. And what Xi is devoted to is making sure that there is no fundamental political reform in China. He does not want to see an evolution. He does not believe that modernization theory is a good thing. He wants to basically go back to an era of dominant party control, of elites sitting, and personally he himself at the top, sitting in charge in Beijing, governing China like an imperial system, but with the party as the dominant fact. And so what that means is things like these protests in Hong Kong go right to the core of what Xi is determined not to let happen. And so the more you do things like say, this is going to be the protest, we're going to liberate Hong Kong, the more you're basically provoking Xi to come in and crack down, because his entire time in office has been devoted to preventing just this kind of protest from going anywhere. It threatens the very source of his rule if it goes too ideological and too large.
Well, Viktor Orban in Hungary is a very interesting case and in part parallels Erdogan and Turkey because the transformations are so striking. Both of them first came to prominence as reformers and Orban as a liberal youth organizer in the late 80s. And as the Eastern Bloc collapsed and he was stridently anti-communist and anti-dictatorship. And now 30 years later, though, he's established what your writer describes as an illiberal democracy at best or a crude autocracy at worst. So is he just an opportunist with no true ideological center?
That's what it seems like. And it's funny, you mentioned Erdogan. By the way, my favorite thing about the Orban side of thing is there was a big profile of what was happening in Hungary, and the American ambassador, Trump's handpicked ambassador to Hungary, was asked what Trump thought of Orban's sort of illiberal democracy and authoritarian powers. And our own ambassador said, oh, God, Trump would love to have the powers that Orban has just taken. And it was just so funny because it sort of references the fact that I think, you know, there are some people who are commonly thought of these days as strong men like Bolsonaro in Brazil or Trump in the U.S. or elsewhere. And they're really just wannabes of the real crowd of doing it like these guys. Erdogan is what's interesting because Erdogan has an element of opportunism like Orban. He has switched from being a passionate religious advocate to being a more technocratic reformer to now being a more authoritarian type. But what's interesting about Erdogan is the thread through all of it is his personal power, and he has a real charisma and authority to him. And he's the one who comes through the most Sphinx-like. Putin and Xi and Orban and the sort of a thuggish Duterte, these all come out real clear characters. Erdogan is still something of a puzzle, as is the Turkey that he rules.
To sum up, I mean, looking at other periods in history when autocrats flourish around the world, what does this particular crop of them tell us about power balances and imbalances in this current moment?
So that's a great question. One of the things it tells us, obviously, is that the third wave of global democracy that flourished in the last quarter of the 20th century clearly has ebbed and receded, and we're now in a kind of neo-authoritarian era in which democracy in general is on the back foot, and authoritarianism, and particularly a kind of personalized, not ideological, not giant bureaucratic machines, but a personalized strongman authoritarianism now seems to be the sort of dominant force in world politics coming up and characterizing this era. But in terms of its long-term significance and trends, that's really hard to say because this is such a bizarre era. And essentially all that's happening now can only be happening with the United States as a feckless AWOL leader of the good guy team. We had a whole alliance. We've run the world in a patchy, clumsy fashion with an alliance of fellow developed nations and democracies, or sort of consortium for a while. And we decided to walk away from that role. And as a result, the world is sort of going around saying, what's happening? And these second tier powers with strong, focused leaders, the mice are playing while the cat's somehow having a nervous breakdown.
Well, Gideon, a huge topic for a short conversation. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Gideon Rose, he's the editor of Foreign Affairs. Coming up, a recent government study found that up to 70% of pork chops in supermarkets can contain drug-resistant bacteria. But that doesn't mean big agriculture is going to let scientists step foot on pig farms to investigate. Tainted pork, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven from Madeline Brand. Drug-resistant infections now pose one of the biggest threats to the 7.5 billion people living on this planet. Think of them like superbugs, bacteria that have built up defenses so they can't be killed by common antibiotics. Increasingly, these germs are popping up in our food supply, sickening, even killing more and more people, and jeopardizing the effectiveness of some of the world's most vital drugs. But in the U.S. pork industry, legal loopholes and powerful industry players effectively block scientists from getting onto the very farms where these infections start. And that deprives them of key information that could help prevent future outbreaks. Matt Richtel is a reporter for the New York Times and wrote about this recently as part of a series the paper has been running on drug-resistant infections called Deadly Germs, Lost Cures. And Matt, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Barbara.
So the particular deadly germ that you look at in this article is a new variant of Salmonella, and it infected 200 people in Washington State in 2015. So tell us about this case and why you chose to look into this case for this series.
So in the summer of 2015, a couple of hundred people got sick from pig roasters, those hefty pigs that you buy on around the holidays and spit roast. And this particular group of pig roasters was carrying a very high concentration of a fast-growing drug-resistant Salmonella.
And you do look at one particular girl named Michaela, and she ate some of this pork. What happened to her?
Yeah, I mean, in short, she nearly died. Her family had gotten this pig roaster as a celebration for a move, actually, they were going to make to Costa Rica. And in the morning after the pig roast, she woke up with a tummy ache. The local doctor said it's just a GI infection. But lo and behold, when she got to Costa Rica, her GI system essentially imploded. And without going into the truly bloody details, she had to be airlifted to a hospital where her life was saved.
Why are we starting to see more outbreaks like this, infections that can't be cured by common antibiotics?
Well, just to clarify, what we're seeing is that bacteria that have previously existed increasingly taking on resistance genes that allow them to defend against our major medications. But it is not correct to say in all cases, or even in many cases, that these bugs aren't curable. They're curable, but only when we expand into our antibiotics that we had hoped to preserve for last resort cases. What does that mean? It means that the more resistance these bugs develop, the more risk it puts on our entire portfolio, narrow portfolio of antibiotics. At some point, there is a fear that we will effectively run out of antibiotics used to cure these bacteria.
And the problem is that many farms use antibiotics prophylactically on the farms instead of just in case of an acute outbreak. Isn't there a law, though, prohibiting the widespread use of antibiotics on farms?
Well, yes. And to clarify, it's overuse of antibiotics in general that causes this. And to explain maybe an obvious mechanism to people, but the more we throw antibiotics into our system, the more the bacteria do what Darwin projected, and they essentially evolve or adapt to be defensive. This includes overuse by humans, and includes vast overuse by farms. The trouble is that it is very hard to understand what the farms are doing because they are not required to disclose their antibiotic use. They can voluntarily provide the information, but it's been exceedingly hard for scientists and regulators and policymakers to know how big the problem is.
Well, why do scientists need access to the farms? Because if they stop the spread of salmonella at the slaughterhouses and the processing plants, isn't that effective?
Well, 1.2 to 1.3 million people get sick from salmonella a year, another 1.3 from Campylobacter, and the fastest growing variant of salmonella is drug resistance. So this is a really big deal in our society, and as the bugs get more resistant, it becomes a much bigger public health issue. If we don't have the data, we can't figure out how to head off these issues.
So help me understand this. If you're a farmer and you've got this potentially lethal strain of bacteria that could very much harm or possibly kill some of your consumers down the road, and that might be spreading from your pigs or your crops, why keep researchers from getting a handle on that and investigating?
I want to take you back to the story we wrote, which was extremely telling in a key respect. After the researchers discovered what slaughterhouse these tainted pigs were coming from, they discovered that the pigs had prior to that come from farms in Montana. The farms in Montana would not allow researchers to come visit to understand the epidemiology, the flow of the disease. Here's what the farms told me. They said, "We feel we will be blamed for a foodborne outbreak when, in fact, the factors are too big to put on us, and therefore it will hurt our business." In other words, we don't trust you researchers and government to fairly keep our reputations.
And what role does the pork industry play then in facilitating this and blocking researchers from getting onto the farms?
Well, this is what the pork industry earnestly says. It believes that unfair blame will be given when, in fact, salmonella is commonplace on farms. In fact, it is not considered an adulterant by the U.S. government, meaning it is so common in farms that it is not expected of farms to rid themselves of salmonella. Therefore, what's happened is the pork industry has used its powerful lobby to prevent any kind of mandatory research with regard to drug-resistant strains on the farms.
So what's the solution to this?
Well, I think the solution is more light, more light, more light. I think that in light of drug resistance, which has been poorly understood because it shares something in common with climate change, like climate change, the actions that each of us does as a consumer taking antibiotics, as a farmer, as a consumer of meat, oftentimes has been hard to connect to an outcome. Meaning, if you and I take an antibiotic, we don't see resistance grow. And therefore, the issue has been easy to ignore. If we can start to establish the clear connections, we can understand the risks posed to our children and grandchildren by our behaviors today.
Well, Matt, thanks for the series, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
New York Times reporter Matt Richtel. Well, if more consumers start having doubts about pork, we could see more people going meatless or at least giving it a try. And plenty of people are already. When Beyond Meat first hit the market in 2014, few thought it would be a success. Fast forward to today.
Yeah, I've seen a lot out here in the West.
But a juicy charbroiled burger with a patty made from plants?
And the same signature taste as our seasoned beef.
First bite, I would know the difference between beef and whatever else you have.
Little do they know, their Whopper patty was actually made from plants.
You're kidding me.
Carl's Jr., Del Taco, Burger King, they've all recently launched foods made with meat alternatives. And turns out people really like it. Del Taco sold over 2 million Beyond Meat tacos in 2 months. It's the most successful product launch ever. Kelsey Piper is a staff writer for Vox, and she's been covering the rise of alt proteins. And hi, Kelsey.
Hi.
So Del Taco has this monster hit, but what about the other franchises, Burger King and the like? How are their meatless burgers doing?
You know, meatless burgers are performing really well everywhere. Burger King launched the Impossible Whopper in a few locations, and it was just such an overwhelming hit that they've actually rolled it out to every single U.S. location now. And overseas, they're doing a promotion with a 50-50 burger. You can buy it and get a 50% chance of an Impossible Burger and a 50% chance of a normal burger. That's how confident they are that consumers can't tell the difference. Qdoba announced a partnership with Impossible Foods. Carl's Jr. sells the Beyond Burger. They're taking off everywhere.
And you've tried, what, the Impossible and Beyond Burgers? And I've had them too. So first, what's in them? And then tell us what they taste like.
So Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods both make all their products from plants. They don't contain any meat products, but they taste almost exactly like beef.
Well, you're a vegetarian, so you maybe don't remember what beef tastes like, but do you have any meat-eating friends who've tried them, and what do they say?
Yeah, we've gone out for taste tests with my more meat-eating friends, and they've all been like, yep, this tastes like a burger. And, you know, this is fast food burgers. We're not at the state of imitating a high-quality steak yet. But for a major thing that people consume beef for, in tacos, in burgers, on sandwiches, these plant-based alternatives just taste a lot like the real thing.
Well, I've got to say, some of them bleed like a burger, like a, you know, either it's beets or I don't know what they put in them. It's kind of red, and that's satisfying. And they do seem to taste much more like a burger than they ever did before, than what I remember from just a few years ago. So what makes them taste more like meat now?
So a big part of this is that teams of food scientists have been working really hard over the last few years to make plant-based meat products that taste just like the real thing. Veggie burgers, of course, have been around for decades, but for a long time, they weren't particularly trying to taste like meat, and they tasted, you know, like beans, like plants. Some people like them, but they weren't going to substitute for meat to people who like meat, and that's what Beyond and Impossible are trying to do. They're not making a product for vegetarians. They're making a product for people who eat meat now, but, you know, maybe they have sustainability concerns, maybe they have health concerns, maybe they have antibiotic resistance concerns, maybe they have climate change concerns. They would go for a plant-based product if they're not giving anything up, if it tastes just as good. So these teams have worked testing thousands of different plants to figure out which things add the flavor profile they're looking for. Impossible Foods get something called heme, which is what gives meat its bloody flavor. They get it from yeast. So previous plant-based products just couldn't imitate that bloody, iron-rich flavor that a burger, especially one that hasn't been cooked all the way through, has. And Impossible was able to imitate it with this product from yeast. So they're just able to make things that taste a lot closer to what we have when we have beef.
And Beyond doesn't use yeast? What do they use?
Beyond does not use yeast. They have different products that have similarly imitated things. Beyond is working really hard for the more natural corner of this market, and Impossible is more willing to go with these sort of out there yeast that has soy proteins in it that they can then put in the burgers. So they're both doing different things, but they've both been pretty successful at making something that tastes like the real thing.
And are you saying that this is a generational trend? You know, say, are baby boomers sticking to beef while millennials are into this this alt meat, or is it just everybody?
So there seems to be consumer interest across the board here. There's lots of people who seem to want to give this a try. A lot of people have tied the rise of plant-based meat to the fact that millennials are very concerned about climate change, very concerned about buying sustainably and buying products that are good for the world. But the interest in plant-based products has by no means been limited to millennials. And I think the companies making these are very much hoping to capture, you know, meat eaters of every walk of life.
What about lab-based meat? Memphis Meats and other startups, they're experimenting with that. So what is lab-grown meat, and when will it hit the market so that we can try it?
Yeah, so this is another thing that people are trying in order to replace slaughtered meat from animals with more sustainable, more environmentally friendly, better for animals alternatives. What they're trying to do is you take some cells from a real animal, a live cow or whatever, and you put it in a solution in a factory that then grows into a steak just on its own, no cow involved. This obviously would be pretty great if we can pull it off. You could make whatever kind of meat products you wanted at a lower environmental footprint and better for the world. But it's very challenging. It's a technical challenge that we haven't solved all the parts of it yet, and we haven't gotten it to an affordable price point yet. So you can't buy that in stores yet. Everything you can get in stores right now is plant-based meat alternatives, and factory-grown steaks are on their way, but I can't tell you whether it could be 5 years or 20. There's still a lot of inventing and refining that needs to happen to get those products to us.
I've heard so far it tastes horrible, somewhere between shoe leather and an old sock.
I think there is a lot of challenges that go into the way meat grows, and it's like a fascinating combination of biology and industrial science trying to figure out how to create something that grows a steak the way a cow grows a steak.
Kelsey, thanks for this.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Kelsey Piper, she's a staff writer for Vox. Coming up, four women accuse a Scientologist of sexual assault and the church of running a stalking campaign and a cover-up. But will yet another scandal have any effect on the church?
The status of the Church of Scientology is one of the great mysteries of the world, because if you look at their materials, and they have an entire television network called Scientology TV, you would think this is the fastest growing and most successful religion in the world.
That's next on Press Play. Press Play, I'm Barbara Bogave. The Church of Scientology, known for its high-profile celebrity members and its involvement in a number of controversies, is facing yet another scandal. Four women have filed suit against the church, alleging they were stalked and intimidated after reporting sexual assault allegations against actor and Scientologist Danny Masterson. Masterson is also named in the suit. Matthew Bellany joins us now. He's editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there.
So first, remind us, what were these initial sexual assault allegations against Danny Masterson?
Well, a number of women have claimed that while they were involved with the Church of Scientology, they were sexually assaulted, they were intoxicated and unable to consent to acts that were committed against them by Masterson. And importantly, they claim that the Church of Scientology prevented them from reporting these and taking action against him because he was such a valued member of the church, which does value celebrities among its members.
Okay, and just to back up, this happened back in the 2000s, and they reported this to the church at the time. Why didn't they go to the police?
Well, that's an interesting one. They believe that the church wanted to handle these things internally, and it was a belief among the leadership of the church that you can't turn against a fellow Scientologist, especially one as high profile as Danny Masterson, that they would have received very big backlash and repercussions for doing so.
Okay, so they eventually now came forward in 2017, and this lawsuit states that they've been harassed by the church ever since. So what are they accusing Masterson and the church of doing? What kind of harassment?
Well, they say that there's been this campaign against them. And, you know, this is not unusual this is not an unusual allegation against the Church of Scientology. There are decades of reports of them going after critics. You know, they have harassed people. They have stalked them. That's pretty well documented. This is interesting because the church has shied away from some of those more aggressive tactics in recent years. The internet has made them, you know, widely available online, and you know they don't sue people like they used to do. But they're claiming that because that this was, these were such explosive allegations, that they have been shamed online, they have had people harassed and called, and they're just, you know, the church is trying to make their lives miserable.
And actually stalked, physically stalked, or is all of this happening digitally?
They claim that there is some physical as well. I mean, if you watch the Leah Remini show on A&E, which is an anti-Scientology show, she's a defector. A lot of times Scientologists will just show up and start, you know, walking around people or start filming them in ways that are uncomfortable but legal. So they claim that they've had these kind of tactics used against them.
Well, it's been around 2 years since the women came forward, and no charges have been filed. Criminal charges have been filed against Masterson. So what is the status of the police investigation into the sexual assault claims?
I mean, it sounds like there is no status. I mean, the DA has declined to prosecute, and this is a bone of contention for a number of anti-Scientologists. They believe that the DA is somehow in cahoots with the church, which has made donations to various people and is posed for photos. You know, I don't know if any of that is true, but there is a sense among the anti-Scientology community that this was not pursued for some, you know, ulterior reason. And in fact, a number of these accusers are going to be featured on the finale of that Leah Remini Scientology show, which airs on A&E. They're going to be talking about this with the hope of somehow convincing the LA DA to re-pick up this case.
Well, these assaults happened back in 2000. So what evidence is there against him?
That's a tough one. That's a real concern. Now, they believe that these accusers believe that because they were in a situation where they were forcibly, in their words, not allowed to, or they would face repercussions for reporting it, that they should be out, you know, allowed to bring these claims later. You know, there are statute of limitations issues with claims of sexual assault. You do have to bring them within a certain time period. So that's a big hurdle for them. And we'll see if the DA is even interested in engaging on this.
How have the church and Masterson responded to the allegations?
They're obviously denying it. Danny Masterson has characterized this as, you know, disgruntled ex-girlfriends. The church vehemently denies that they would ever pressure anyone into not reporting a sexual assault against a fellow member. Scientology, as you mentioned, is involved in a number of scandals, and they have a very aggressive media strategy. They always put out big statements. They have websites they create. They do a lot of aggressive countermeasures against these kinds of claims. And now this is civil litigation. If this case proceeds, they're going to have to respond in court.
Well, you just referenced, you know, the past history of allegations and scandals against the Church of Scientology in the church. And you also mentioned that they're doing pretty well in their outreach online. So what's the status of the church these days? I mean, have they taken a big hit for their history, or is it just standing stronger than ever?
The status of the Church of Scientology is one of the great mysteries of the world, because if you look at their materials, and they have an entire television network called Scientology TV, you would think this is the fastest growing and most successful religion in the world. They're opening new centers, they're recruiting new people, everything's great. But then you watch a show like the Leah Remini show, which talks to a lot of the people who are defecting and a lot of the people who have alleged abuses by the church. And that show and the general climate of exposure of some of these allegations has really hurt the church, according to the critics of the church. And many people believe that the ranks of Scientologists are dwindling around the world. Doesn't matter financially for the church, because they have a real estate empire that is billions of dollars big, and they have tax-exempt status because they were recognized federally as a religion. So that's one of the things that the Leah Remini show has really gone after, is to try to revoke this tax-exempt status. But so far, there's been no action by the government on that front either.
Well, Matthew, thanks for this.
Thank you.
Matthew Bellany is editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter. And Steve Chiatakis is here with the skinny on his show, Greater LA. Hey, Steve.
I don't even know how to follow that, but I can tell you we have a new city councilman in the 12th LA district. His name is John Lee.
Yes, we do.
He won the election on Tuesday. His opponent has conceded the race, and he will take over in a few weeks when the race is certified from the L.A. County Clerk's Office in Norwalk. So we'll hear from him coming up on some of his ideas. He's the lone Republican on a dais full of Democrats in Los Angeles, so you can imagine what he's up against as well.
Oh, good. I'm eager to hear this.
All right.
Coming up on our show, our guest comes from a famous Hollywood family, but all he ever wanted to do was play hockey. Wyatt Russell on his winding path to starring in the unlikely hit show Lodge 49. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. For a lot of Southern Californians, Long Beach is an eclectic and beautiful place to live and visit. But AMC's show Lodge 49 portrays Long Beach a little differently, as a magical center of self-discovery and alchemy. The show just began its second season this week on AMC. It focuses on the Lynx Lodge number 49. It's a social club kind of like an Elks Lodge or Moose Lodge, but way more spiritually wacky and mysterious. Wyatt Russell stars as Sean Dudley, a charmingly dopey surfer struggling to cope with the death of his father. Russell comes from a family of actors. His father is Kurt Russell, his mother Goldie Hawn. But despite his Hollywood lineage, he took a winding path to the family business, including a stint as a pro hockey player along the way. And Wyatt Russell, it is good to talk with you on Press Play.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Lodge 49, it's a hard show to pin down.
Right?
I remember watching the pilot and thinking, wow, this is a really likable head scratcher. What did you think when you first read the script?
I had that same feeling. When I read scripts, I mostly at first pass read them for visceral reaction. So I'll read it, and if I feel as if it's something that hits me in a way that I'd like to read it again to read it deeper, then I will. If it doesn't, then I know it's probably not for me. And that script, which was so different and so tonally specific, the way he explained how the sun hit the side of somebody's face or the time of day mattered. And I knew that he was trying to go for more than just some sort of plot-driven show, which as an actor, when you're doing TV, you don't want to get stuck doing something for 5 or 6 years that inevitably becomes a soap opera. I just didn't. That's fine. It's great. And those are all good. But I just didn't care to do that. So the one thing that I knew about this show is it would never become a soap opera.
Well, that's for sure.
It would always stay on. Yeah.
And it is kind of more about mood than plot, which is, I think, is so fitting for a show set in Los Angeles, which is so much about mood. And it's also set in this lodge. Why a lodge?
I think it's all about the friendships and the relationships that people make in there. That's what it's there for. And in today's world, where you've got phones and internet, email, social media, everything that's supposed to make you feel more connected. Of course, you've heard it a million times. People sometimes feel like they're less connected. And this show shines a light on a place and places that still exist but are dwindling where you can really go to be with people. Just share your common human experience face-to-face, which is something we don't probably do as good anymore as we used to.
Yeah, and they're mysterious. I mean, I've never been in an Elks Lodge or the Lions Club. I think women can go in lodges. I don't even know. Did you research?
No, I didn't do any research because Dud wouldn't know anything anyway. You know, he's learning as he goes.
He's not a homework kind of guy.
So I figured, what's the point of knowing, you know, what all of this means? Because he has no idea. There are some things that I've, you know, gathered along the way, but that's really Jim's area of expertise.
Jim Gavin,
the creator of the show. Yes. Yeah.
We should tell people who haven't seen the show what your character is all about, Dud, as he's called, because he has this tragic history. He nearly died on a surfing trip after being bitten by a venomous snake. That's where the show starts, and it left him with this permanent limp. And his father allegedly drowned body surfing, and that left Dud and his sister Liz with this crippling debt from the family's failing business, a pool business. And then at the end of season one, just when things are starting to come together, Dud gets back in the water and he encounters a shark. I mean, this guy just gets slammed by just about every California hazard, right? I mean, he's like an LA version of Job.
That's funny. Dud is in an ever-changing mode of his life where it seems like at every corner something is there to get him. The end goal of everyone's life, but specifically Dud, and he says it in season two in the pilot, Blaze asks him, if you could do anything in the world, what would you want to do? And very quickly, Dud goes, well, it's easy, I'd clean pools. And it's like, that's all you'd want to do? But it's kind of the thesis of the show, to me, where if you want something very, very simple, and your nirvana, quote unquote, is something very, very simple, then you have to jump through hoops of fire and go through hell to get to that very simple place.
Well, how do you relate to this character? I mean, does this really speak to you in your life?
Not specifically in the specifics of what he does, but I think what drew me to it and keeps drawing me back to it is that it's a metaphor for what everybody goes through. And the metaphors of being bitten by a snake and all those things, those allegories, have been around for a very long time. And it is, in a way, from my life and how it's gone, just in terms of how I've dealt with my own stuff, that nobody, you know, it's like nobody else cares and nor should they, but everyone has to deal with their own thing. Whatever snakes and dragons they have to slay, you have to do it. You have to go through it. If you don't, then you're not going through the gauntlet. You have to run the gauntlet to get to the other side. And the gauntlet is different for everybody, and there's different circumstances and thresholds for everybody. So for me, that part of the story does connect, and I think that, you know, in different characters, people see different parts of themselves. Not everybody sees themselves in Dud, obviously.
Well, while you were talking, I was thinking, well, maybe your gauntlet was you were playing, trying to get a foothold in professional hockey, and you got injured, right? Do you consider that your kind of come to Jesus experience?
Yeah, it was a very long road, and it gave me a real sense of self-worth that I could take with me into my new life, whatever that ended up being. At the time, I didn't know. I just thought it was going to be hockey. You know, it gave me the ability to go, people say, I don't like you, or I don't like this, or I don't like that, or you're bad. It gave me the ability to go, oh, sorry, you feel that way, but I'm continuing forward. So good luck on your path, and I'll be on mine, and I hope you have a very nice life.
Well, you spent 7 years as a goalie in junior and professional hockey. How did that happen anyway, and why hockey?
My mom was working in Toronto. My dad took me to a rink when I was 3 to play, to just, you know, put on skates, just kill time. And I fell in love with it. First memory I ever had, and fell in love with the game. Then he put me in a league. I progressed. I became good enough to look like I could maybe pursue a college scholarship. When I was about 13 or 14, that's when you kind of start to know. Went to go play hockey in college. I left college 2 years in to go play European professional hockey because I wanted an experience in life, and it looked like I wasn't going to play in the NHL. I was having injury issues. So I went over there trying to do that, and 3 years into that, my hip blew up, and I have a hip condition that I had to have surgery on.
I was thinking of you playing hockey. I'm from Philadelphia, and you know, big fan of the Flyers. And I know how hard people hit in hockey. And I'm picturing, you know, you're the son of these famous rich Hollywood movie stars, and you're pretty. You got long blonde hair. Was every hockey player on the ice just out to beat the crap out of you?
Yeah, in the beginning, yeah. I was 15, and this guy on another team, Abbotsford, basically, it was my second game, I think it was my second game, and he came around the net, and he said, "I'm going to knock your effing teeth down your throat and get in People magazine." And it was a real eye-opener, where it was like, okay.
Oh, wow. And I'm sure he's not the first person who's like...
And he was 20 years old. And 16 to 20 is obviously a very big difference for a man that age. And there was a scuffle, and he didn't knock my teeth down my throat, but he tried. And I realized if I wanted to do this, that was part of the sport, and that's how you're going to earn the respect of the people in the sport. That's dumb as it may sound, that's what it is, and that's what I wanted to do. So I went along with it, and I put my head down, and I didn't talk, and I won games, and that was the way that people finally went, okay, you know what, he's not a circus act, he's good, and he means well, and he's a good kid, and blah, 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 blah. You know, I spent a couple years probably proving to people that that's the way I was, and I wasn't some, like, entitled kid from Hollywood to, you know, movie star parents.
Right, and then you got injured, and...
yeah, much later down the line, yeah.
Yeah, so did you, you know, with parents like Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn, did you always think that in the back of your mind, I'll become an actor? Or did you think the opposite, I'll never do that, I'll never do what they did?
It was the opposite for me, where, you know, that just seemed... Well, it was the same. It was the thing of everyone coming up to me going, why don't you just do that? And it's like, well, because I don't. That's not what I do. I play hockey, and I'm good at it. So partly it became a rebellious streak in me of going, well, I'm not going to do it because everyone's saying, why don't you do it? And the other part was I just didn't really have an interest. And then I got hurt when I was 20, and that's a whole other injury story. But it was the first time I really went, well, you know what, I might not play hockey forever. So I went to USC summer film program. And I loved it. I had the greatest time. I met great people that weren't hockey players, which was the first time that I met people that were friends who weren't athletes. And I had a real eye-opening experience there. And I left going, you know what, this could be a really fun world to live in.
We're out of time, so I'm gonna jump ahead. I'm gonna completely skip your entire successful career.
Good.
and move on to this question, that you've been an athlete and now an actor. And I recently saw this film you were in with the actor and comedian Alex Karpovsky. Folk hero and funny guy.
Yeah, and my fiance, Meredith Agner.
Oh, I didn't realize that was your...
Yeah.
Okay, she was great. So you played the folk hero in that. It's a road trip movie. And I think you were singing at least some of the songs. Is that right? Do you play? And
I sang all this. Meredith and I actually wrote songs together for that movie.
That's wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, and I sang. That's all live. That's all live singing and live playing. I play guitar and sing so that was all done live. And we thought that was pretty fun to do it. And we did the shot that in Atlanta, and we thought it was going to be pretty fun to do it all live, and it really was.
So is that the next thing for you? You're going to move on to
music? What, play music?
Yeah.
Music means a lot to me. And I always find that when actors end up going out and doing music, it never quite holds the weight that you thought it was going to when you were maybe 17 years old and writing songs. And I've just kept that for me. For now, I don't ever necessarily... I'll never say never. But for now, Meredith and I, we write songs together for ourselves and have fun doing that around the house. I can be curmudgeon-y and she'll be like, let's write a song. And I'm like, well, I don't feel like it. You know, but yeah, I don't know if I'll ever pursue that as a career.
Well, we'll see. And I wish you both the best.
Thank you very much.
Wyatt Russell, star of Lodge 49. You can see it on AMC. Hey, Michelle Aloy.
Hi, Barbara.
What are people thinking about outside of this room?
Well, we asked our listeners if they had tried the Impossible Burger or the Beyond Meat, and apparently a lot of them have. Charles Sidner says, I've had all of them and have enjoyed them all, although guiltily we're talking about fast food here, the restaurants that serve them. He says he enjoys them guiltily, though, because it's all junk food. The Impossible Whopper tastes no different from the way I remember the real thing. Stephen Kipple says Beyond is better than regular Del Taco meat. Impossible at Burger King is hardly different than the original. Beyond Meat at Carl's Jr. is good, but has to be cooked through.
I have to chime
in
there.
It here?
Really matters how you cook them. Like, if you give them a char, then it's so convincing.
Yeah.
But if they're that kind of squishy, you know, with no caramelization...
Well, I bought some of the Impossible Burgers. I kind of screwed up, though, because we bought them and we were going to grill them, and then but not that day, so we threw them in the freezer, and then we pulled them out, and then noticed the big sign that says don't refreeze, and then we were like, oh my God, are we going to die? We didn't. Spoiler alert. I'm still here.
That's a mess.
But that did have like a little bit of a taste, but we haven't tried it since we, you know, by following the directions.
Well, I'm not surprised our audience has tried these because, you know, they're a healthful bunch.
And people seem to think that they do taste pretty convincing. I mean, I certainly thought it was pretty convincing as a meat eater myself. I think that's the interesting thing is this stuff seems targeted specifically for people who are meat eaters but are maybe trying to cut some of that out but don't necessarily want, like, the veggie patty per se.
No, they want that umami.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for this.
Anytime.
And thanks for listening, all of you. Don't forget, you can download Press Play, the podcast, and listen whenever you want. I'll see you tomorrow.